This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
We were in some tough places, and what we kept seeing was that landlords were treating our people terrible. They were giving them the bare minimum. Though they may have been paying rent, they weren't getting the quality of standard. And that was something that we both kept saying as we were walking through these properties, like, man, these people deserve better.
Welcome to Color Money Podcast. My name's Bo Minkiti, and I am joined today by my amazing co-host, Emmerich Peace, and the amazing Julia Lachey. Today, we have an amazing guest. His name is Michael Meredith, and he is the co-founder and CEO of VPG Enterprises in New Orleans. And I'm very excited to have Michael with us today. VPG that he runs and that he started is a New Orleans-based real estate development firm that's known for executing transformative urban projects. He launched the company in 2010. And, you know, since then, they've gone through a tremendous amount of growth with over $100 million in assets in their portfolio and about $300 million in upcoming development projects in their pipeline. Michael is a visionary leader who's got a strong foundation in chemical engineering from Tuskegee University and also was a baseball player. He's built his career around sort of disciplined execution and community impact. VPG's been one that was the fastest growing firm named by Inc. Magazine in New Orleans and the top 10 real estate companies in the nation. He's a great guy, a good friend. And when we launched the Obsidian Catalyst Fund to support diverse developers and growing their companies, he was the first company that we invested with and in. Michael Meredith, we're excited to have you with us today.
I appreciate it, Bo. I feel like you rehearsed that. You got that down 100%.
It was great.
Get your flowers while you're alive. I got my whole bouquet from Bo and this one. So I really, truly appreciate that.
Well, it's exciting to have you with us. Well, you know, you have a kind of unique experience, and I think in sort of how you came to real estate. And so maybe let's go all the way back and wherever you want to start and tell us a little bit about your journey to starting VPG and how you got there.
You know, my background is in sports. So I did play baseball, played in college and got a chance to play a little professionally. Post that, you know, out of that moment of being cut as a baseball player, which, you know, we all will get, you know, no matter if it's at 9 years old or 4 years old, you're going to get cut by the team. But that was my motivational moment to really start a business. And, you know, was working for Chevron as petroleum engineer and offshore, you know, drilling deep water wells. So spending 2 weeks on the rig, 90 miles, and nothing but blue water. And a good friend of mine, frat brother and best friend, you know, we both wanted to get off the rig, literally. We read the Rich Dad, Poor Dad book and figured this was our quickest way to wealth. And that was really the initial spark, you know, that I think was to VPG in that moment. And we digested as many books and podcasts and YouTube videos and seminars as we could. And I think the biggest thing for us was really just, you know, taking action in 2010, 11, and just buying that first Craigslist property, right? And was it the best property? No, but it really gave us that confidence to say, hey, we could take a step and move this forward, and we haven't looked back since.
Well, tell us a little bit about this. You know, you started the business with a good friend, right? Fraternity brother. Like, what was that like? Sound kind of romantic. Everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna start this business with my friend. But these guys are like, you know, we're 15 years later. And they got the fastest growing company in New Orleans. It wasn't like some little side project like, hey, buddy, let's get together and try this little hobby. You guys made it work. And so can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm going to say this delicately. It's like going through the fraternity process, you know, kind of melds you together, right? And it shows, you know, who a person is when you have to hit adversity. And so when we said we're going to start a business together, we kind of knew each other. We trusted each other across a bunch of different gambits. And we understood that the work ethic was there, right? We both were doing 2 weeks on the rigs, right? In our 2 weeks off, we were in our two-bedroom apartment, you know, coming up with this grand scheme of how we were going to build this billion-dollar, you know, real estate company. And that work started there. So, you know, literally, like, putting together hand 1,000 envelopes to send out to potential owners, riding around neighborhoods and being a janitor, being the property manager, putting appliances in when we're not electricians. Like all those things, you know, were things that really show like, hey, this is not just for the money. It's something that we both have, you know, passion about. And even in our other vertical with our construction company, bringing on another one of our Lyon Brothers events, you know, the same thing was there, is really wanted to align with folks where it was bigger than just money, right? Because we all know it, in that instance, sometimes it comes, sometimes it goes, but do you really have a passion for, you know, building better communities and making an impact and inspiring? That was something that, in those two guys, I know 100% has always been there, will continue to be there as well, too.
That's a beautiful thought where you said, even without the money, because a lot of times we form partnerships and it sounds like a great idea. We're good friends. And then we talk about the money, and the money gets between the relationship, the money gets between the business partnership. And I can definitely relate to that one. And one of the things that, and I'm going to ask you this question, whether you pass or fail depends on your answer, okay? Do you guys count the money? Do you count their money? Do they count your money?
No, we don't count each other's money.
Ah. Right?
So, but what we do count is the business's money, right?
You're like, we're counting somewhere. There's some count going on.
Yeah. You know, that, I think in that instance, you know, we try to be fair. And look, there's some tough conversations where we're all not necessarily compensated the same, but it's fair in what is going on. And that's just never something that I think has been top of mind of that aspect, because I think we were all so aligned to the mission. And, right, you know, if the company is doing what it's supposed to do and being profitable, all the other trickle down things will come, you know, come into effect.
Now, by the way, you did pass.
Okay.
Let's make that clear. And so that's the conversation, because you talked about going into business with your frat brothers, your friends. And a lot of people say, well, you don't do business with friends and family. As long as you manage expectations and you put things out there up front, everybody's super clear about the direction that you're going. And that's true. You can't count money. You just can't count money. Once you start counting money, that's the demise of the relationship, because now the relationship is about money and not about the mission, as you said. So,
but you know what? He said something also that I heard that was really important. And he said we have the same common, I think you said mission or vision. I can't remember. Mission. You have the same
mission.
The same mission. Yeah. And it's a lot of times when we speak to high capacity leaders or high achieving real estate brokers, developers, whatever they might be, particularly with people who have played sports. You mentioned that you played baseball. They talk about having a common mission. And I think that's a part when somebody goes into partnership with someone that's missing, is what is the mission that you're on? Do you have the same mission, or do you have the same vision? And so a lot of times I think we kind of skimmed over that, but that's really important to not just partnerships, but business in general. Michael, how did you know that you all had the same mission in mind when you set out to partner with him?
Really, I think that came out of our initial walks through these properties, right? And so you can imagine where, you know, we're 23, 24 years old, and we're walking in some neighborhoods in New Orleans that we didn't know as bad. We were naive, right? Right. You know, we were in some tough places. And what we kept seeing was that landlords were treating our people terrible, right? Is they were giving them the bare minimum. Though they may have been paying rent, they weren't getting the quality of standard. And that was something that we both kept saying as we were walking through these properties, like, man, these people deserve better. Mm. And I think when we sat down and we tried to actually verbalize that into an actual statement, you know, that building better communities is really, really what came out of that, right? And so I think as we started to think about how do we invest into a property, yeah, we could skim off here and make some more profits, but do we invest the extra dollars that will pay off long term and make our tenant happy? You can see we were both leaning towards the same way. And I think that really, you know, just showed that we were, you know, aligned in that sense. Mm-hmm.
So from that first Craigslist property to $100 million in assets, and also now I think helping to lead, right, the River District neighborhood, mm-hmm. which is going to be one of the most transformative projects in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
How did all that happen? Like what were the keys to success over the last 15 years? Like what made that, what drove that? Yeah.
I mean, I think for us is one is being creative. and how we finance and structure deals, right, is when you don't have money, you got to get creative. And so that first pocket of deals where we had left our W-2 jobs, we didn't have a bunch of liquid capital, you know, we had to become financial engineers at that moment. How do we use subject to, bond for deed, owner finance deals that allowed us to build some, you know, cash flow and liquidity that way? You know, that was a large part of that, mixed with kind of that just kind of hustle, right, where you're out knocking on doors and sending letters and all those components. And then you graduate to more local and regional banks, right? So that gives you a little bit more firepower, you know, where you can have some debt and go and raise some family and friends, you know, type of equity. So that was kind of our second phase. We built a great relationship with the bank here that really supported us, saw our vision, and a group of local investors kind of came along with us as well in that component. And so you kind of get in that small curve, and then you kind of hit that exit ramp on the exponential curve is when you start to get into the institutional investors, right? And so getting linked with Goldman Sachs in 2018 really put us in that trajectory where we're able to take down larger assets, be able to attract institutional equity investors. So, you know, that's 15 years, right, of like day by day just hitting the stone, right? But being able to be creative in how we structure deals, to be able to take what our past experiences package that up to make it, you know, marketable to larger investors has really, I think, been the key for us.
So talk a little bit about the strategy. Like, what is your business's strategy? What does your business do?
We're opportunistic investors, right? You know, I think we're looking for, you know, deals that we can implement some type of value add, you know, being vertically integrated, having our own management firm, having our own construction firm.
I'm going to cut you off for one second because Julia always get me on this because she says, I use two big words, do stuff. And I noticed.
No, it's not that you use two big of words. Just explain them when you like.
Recently, we've had a lot of real estate developers and investors on. And so they do a lot of developers. So maybe you could help with our listeners. So what does a value add investment strategy mean, like in layman's terms? Can you talk through that? And then can you, after that, you could do what vertically integrated is. That actually might be helpful to some of the people on the call who aren't as attuned. Yeah, we have some people that are coming from the same space as you and some are coming from a different space. And so get everyone on the same language.
When we say value add, I mean, we're going into a property, going to make some changes to increase, you know, the revenue and or decrease the expenses, right? And so we're not kind of buying a mutual fund that we're looking at, you know, consistent returns. You know, we're not at the blue chip type of assets as of yet, right? We want to identify something that has a problem. It's like buying a business, right? Like you see a business that has an issue, whether it's on the revenue or expenses, and we feel like our company can bring something in to be able to increase the revenue, decrease the expenses, and therefore increase the overall value of the property, right? And so those deals usually come, I want to say, with a little bit of hair, but they're the TV at Best Buy that says, you know, it's already, you know, you get a little extra discount because somebody is
using scratch and dent.
Right. Scratch and dent. If you're a mechanic and you know how to get that dent out, that car looks brand new, right? Mm-hmm. So you've created value in that piece, right? So, you know, that is how we look at deals. And I think that kind of speaks to the next component of the vertically integrated is, you know, we have an in-house construction team that performs for us and other clients, and we have an in-house property management firm. And so those special skills allow us to see some of those value areas that other investors may not. That construction firms allows us to be more efficient in how we put, you know, dollars out into play that other firms may not have, right? So those are kind of our special tools that allow us to extract value from a deal when we buy it.
So your deals, I know you say you're an opportunistic investor. Mm-hmm. What's your sweet spot? Is it affordable housing? Is it a mixed use? What's your sweet spot?
Our sweet spot is mixed income, right?
Okay.
Is, you know, specifically here in this New Orleans market, you know, where we see pipeline and we think we'll continue to see pipeline is, you know, mixed income deals. So deals that either have a truly affordable component to it or workforce housing, you know, component to us. We know that those deals are a little bit more recession, I want to say proof, but recession resistant, right?
Right.
So usually mixed income deals, 100 units or greater, really kind of fit into our profile.
So when you say mixed, you mean market rate and?
Market rate and affordable.
Affordable, okay. Yeah.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
And one of the really interesting things, you know, I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but Michael kind of identified an opportunity. If you look at the timing, there's a 15-year compliance period on these low-income housing tax credit deals, in which case they sort of come out of that phase, they enter into second phase of activity where there's still an affordability component, but it changes a little bit. And because the hurricanes drove so much of what happened, Hurricane Katrina drove so much of the rebuilding of New Orleans, much of that product was rebuilt and is coming to the end of its 15-year period right now, right? And so Michael has had a strategy that's been really helpful in looking at the macro context of his community and how those assets were financed and how he could play a role in the next season of affordability and what's happening in New Orleans. That leads me to a question that I've always been really amazed by your ability in what I perceive to be as a relatively closed environment. I don't perceive Louisiana or New Orleans to be the most like, hey, let's welcome in some new people or some people who don't look like us. And you seem to have done an amazing job of being part of a community. And when I say a community, I don't mean like, a lot of people say they're part of the community, but they're just part of their community. Does that make sense? Like their neighborhood or their thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Michael's part of the whole New Orleans community, like everybody. and it was amazing for me because I rolled up to his property and I talked to the brokers he had involved. We talked to the bankers he had involved. And I was like, man, these are some good old New Orleans people. And he had like four different groups. There were a lot of communities at the table, all that make up the broader community. And so you strike me as someone who has been amazingly adept at building relationship, creating trust and connection between all parts of the communities that make up the macro community of the place you're in. So tell us, was that always the case from day one, or was that a hard thing to build?
Very hard. So I think, you know, New Orleans is a community that, you know, has its charm, right? Mm-hmm. And it is a business environment that likes to do business with folks that are from New Orleans, right? So you can imagine an outsider who didn't go to high school here, which is the number one, you know, determining factor of if you're cool or not. It's taken some time, right? And I think recognizing that it would early on, I think was a key, right? Is you can get very frustrated and not having the doors open as wide as you can, or you can just kind of keep on knocking until they do, right? And I think I'm really appreciative of my partners, Vince and Dre, who really hold down a lot of operational, like day-to-day things that kind of allows me to build those relationships, to spend the time, you know, at the networking events and all the things that it really takes to kind of, I would say, you know, crack the eggshell, right? Because usually it's not as thick as we think, right? Mm-hmm. You have the right conversation over a cocktail, or you make a connection on somebody's sports team. You help somebody's kid get into the right internship. Like all those little things, you know, really, I think, open the doors to some of those things that are just culturally created, but at the same time, it just take time to maturate. And so I think being intentional, using the warm introduction, right? Because somebody may say no, but their friend will say, hey, you need to meet Michael, right? Like those are things that I think have been helpful, but it just takes time and effort. And, you know, you can spend, you know, hours and hours on a P&L, but you can spend 5 minutes, you know, over a cocktail and, you know, get the same results.
How did you and Bo meet? Because, Bo, I think you mentioned that Michael was part of the Promise Development. Is it a foundation that you have? Is it a foundation?
No, it's part of the Obsidian Catalyst Fund, which is a real estate private equity fund that we developed that came out of some research showing that there was a large number of talented Black and Latino-run real estate development firms that were hitting a glass ceiling when it came to scale. That they would all grow to a certain point and they couldn't grow beyond that. And so we worked with a number of investors, including Northwestern Mutual and some real estate families and foundations, to launch the Obsidian Catalyst Fund, which was focused on companies that could break through that ceiling. They were in a place where they were ready to break through that ceiling around a thesis of investing and creating livable, quality, attainable housing for people in urban centers. And so, so that launched the end of last year. And a project with Michael was the first investment that fund made in New Orleans.
Wow. And so is that how you met him, Michael? Did you meet him or was it over a cocktail? Was it because a favor for a favor? I know y'all not lying, brother. So it wasn't that.
It was through a conference. And somebody went to I sent someone to a conference because I couldn't go. And I said, you know what? Let me send one of our other team members. And she went and she met Michael there. So I'll let Michael tell the rest of the story.
Yeah. And Natasha is wild. She's actually coming in town this weekend and we're getting brunch again. But she came to a conference where we were presenting and she saw me on a panel with another investor in one of our deals. And we connected there and we said, hey, we're going to try to find a deal to do together. And, you know, oddly enough, the first deal that we tried to go after, it didn't work, right? It wasn't a fit per se in that part of it, but we just continued to stay in touch. And I was pretty persistent that I wanted to meet Bo, right? Because I think, you know, it's one thing to invest, but, you know, you really invest with somebody that you haven't looked them in the face or shook their hand. And so I think we had breakfast the day before Thanksgiving and just kind of talked through the deal and some deal points. And for me, I think it gave me a lot of trust to Bo and knowing that, hey, this is real. And the questions that he was asking, I think, you know, really kind of set the path forward for that first investment. So no cocktail, but a really, really good gluten-free waffle.
That's right.
So before, if I could ask you all, because before we went live, you know, Michael, Bo asked you if there was something specific you wanted to talk about, something that was on your heart. And you actually did bring up something that has been on my heart this week as well. It's just that you have a very successful business and the current challenges and struggles of, be it, I don't know if we want to call it the political environment, the social environment, the whatever environment this is.
D, all of the above.
All of the above has made it a little more challenging, particularly for Black-owned businesses. Can you speak to that a little bit?
We've transitioned from an environment where I think it was very marketable to be aligned with Black businesses. And we are in a climate where it's the exact opposite, right? Where companies, investors are changing terms, changing program names, changing investment thesis around, you know, companies that look like mine. And so, you know, there is a pivot that we're going to have to make, right? You know, and that is something that's always on my mind on a daily basis is how do we position our company that, you know, is going to still be investable, right? And that is still going to be able to market itself as not, you know, purely a Black-owned business, right? But as a business itself that can generate market rate returns. So that's kind of, you know, step one. But also two is we've also got to be intentional about who we partner with, right? And how do we as a community come together to continue to build wealth and maybe take that extra chance, right? Or take the extra call or get a little bit more aggressive on our marketing to folks that look like us because our pool is smaller. But we know that DEI doesn't stop in our community, right? It's a daily thing. And so I think I'm just constantly thinking about how to create more organic communities that can still invest into our businesses that can collaborate with each other. Because if we don't, then we're going to have a lot of our businesses that won't make it.
What you're saying is just so true. But here's the other thing. I believe that a lot of times it's a little more challenging. We can find the business that with people that look like us that want to do business with us.
Uh-huh.
It's a little more challenging. We got to put a little bit more effort, not a little bit, a lot more effort into it. And we got to find those. And those are the real relationships that will probably transcend that deal and go into another deal. Hence the conversation with you and Bo. The first deal didn't work. It didn't fit the model. The second deal did, and it fit because you were persistent with pursuing that relationship. And I believe that a lot of us have to, you know, be real that we give up too soon.
And also we could take it personal, right?
Right.
So I think that is a key thing is that you shouldn't do the deal just because I look like you. You should do the deal because it's a good deal.
Right.
And the fact that if we were to get into a bad deal together because we look like each other, that makes it even worse.
Right.
So I think in that moment, you know, that was something that I learned early on is especially in real estate, is not to take it personal, because this person doesn't want to do your deal doesn't mean this person doesn't, right? And vice versa, right? And finding that sweet spot in the continued conversation, you know, means a lot. Because I've had guys that, you know, on a smaller level, we invest in the deals, and I've had to say no, and they get upset. It's like, well, that just lets me know I don't want to do the next deal with you, right? Because your thesis is not correct. But I agree with you 100%.
Can you talk a little bit about how you've thought about growing the next phase of your business? Like, you've entered into sort of this next period. What inspired you to want to sort of do that? And what does that look like for you and for VPG?
I want to piggyback on it, because you said something really clear. You said 100 units. And adding on to Bo, what's the 100 units plus in that conversation with Bo as far as the next level?
Yeah, so I'll hit your question first, Emmerich. And really for us, we try to focus on 100 units or greater on an apartment deal just because it gives us scale, right? And so, you know, to be able to spend the amount of time and our resources and how our organization is put together, like, that's what best fits us. If, you know, for us to manage a 50-unit property, we're not really getting the efficiency that we would need. And so kind of that 100 units or greater mark makes it investable on our end on that front.
That's not how you started, right?
Oh, no, no, no,
okay,
no.
Just for some context, that's how he's going forward. Right. He just got there, right? Yeah,
2 days ago. Hey, when it first started, we'll take a half a unit, right? We'll split this unit in half and get it. Right. But yeah, that is a more recent revelation. But I think it is there to the second point, to make sure that we can scale. A part of that is geographic. We know that we won't get to our, you know, 5 and 10 year goals by only investing into New Orleans. And so there's other markets that we're, you know, currently looking at to be able to make that happen. And another part of that is partnership, right? Is in any real estate deal, if you know, very few of us have the wealth and the ability to do a deal ourselves, right? You know, we got a bank or equity partner or, you know, a co-developer or something in the deal, right? And so that's an important part of our growth strategy, is making sure that we're finding the right partners in these different geographic areas to be able to expand and hit our goals.
Let's talk a little bit on the personal side. You know, for you, when you think about wealth and legacy for you, for your family, like, what are some of the things you think about and what are some of the things you work on?
You know, time is ultimately what it's about for me, right? Is I enjoy what I do on a daily basis. So I don't wake up like I'm going to work, right? I get a chance to wake up and hit my mission. But I'm also a husband, and one day I plan to be a father. And so creating the space and the energy for my wife to go and go after things she wants to do, right? And not the thing that she has to do. And for my kids to be able to have the ability to do the things that they want to do and not have to do. It's kind of what drives me, right? And also, you know, being able to be, you know, philanthropic. I'm very involved in the church and our missions, and being able to go overseas and support and serve people. Like, those are the important things of wealth creation, you know, for me. And then also, you know, being able to just enjoy, right? To travel and see the world and see what God has created, not only just in our continent, but, you know, all over the world. Those are things that are critical to me, but planning on the front end, right? You know, I see this as probably a sprint over the next 15 to 20 years, and probably maybe a slower jog past that, right? I don't think I'll ever stop running in this real estate space, but, you know, really having the time, energy to mentor, to pour back in. And I know, you know, that the wealth building allows, and the past income allows, the ability to do that as well too.
I thought it'd be really interesting for Michael to share what it is you guys look for in a property. So we got a lot of folks, a lot of our listeners are folks who are either own some investment property, are in the business of doing real estate development, or might be successful real estate salespeople who are trying to buy their first rental home. But I'd be interested in how you walk through your analysis of what do you look for in a potential, when you're going to buy a piece of real estate, what do you look for in that real estate? What are you looking for?
Yeah. So the first thing is I'm looking at how we found it. Right. If the deal is heavily marketed and everybody, you know, we're a multifamily, right? And if we're dealing multifamily 100 units plus, let's call it 90% of the deals are, you know, some national broker that's sending it out to firms all across the nation, right? And typically that's not best suited for what we do, right? We're trying to find a special situation that we could add, that VPG could add value to. And so if I get a deal that comes across my desk and I feel like 1,000 people have seen it, you know, there's probably 100 folks that probably can pay more than I can, right? And so that's kind of the first, is how it's marketed. Is this an exclusive opportunity? Two is like, you know, what is the quality of the asset, right? Is this an asset that we feel like is going to fall apart in the next, you know, 5-10 years? You know, is it bricks? Is it siding? Does it have water issues? Like, just kind of the basic things. You walk around a car and see, hey, you know, do I even want to get inside of it, type of deal. And then we start to really dive into the financials, right? Is, you know, where are the rents now versus where we think the rents are going to be? Is there something in the operating expenses where we feel like immediately our team can come in and reduce? And our team is quickly trying to identify what is the value creation, like we talked about earlier, and if there is that component. And if that checks out, then we start thinking about, okay, how do we tell this story to our debt partners? How do we tell this story to our equity partners? And if that becomes compelling, right, then we know we have something, right? You know, we've got an exclusive opportunity that's a high quality asset that has a clear value play that we can tell a story to our investors. And if those things start to come together, then that is where we really start to move the needle and push forward, you know, into taking a deal down.
Anything that you think has been mistakes you've made in buying real estate over the years? Like, if you had to point out, like, hey, here's one or two things I learned along the way, like, these are mistakes I made when I was thinking about buying real estate.
And there have been times where you ignore the numbers, right? You look at a deal and it feels good, or it's in a, you know, an area that looks good, or you feel like, hey, this would look really good on, you know, our prior experience tab in our pitch deck, right? So I think, you know, early on, there were some deals that looked really good and we were hoping the numbers would be good. And I'm glad we made those mistakes at a smaller level. And even then, you know, it really just didn't match what our investment horizon was going to be. Those deals turned out to be good deals based on appreciation. But when we were thinking about immediate cash flow and how we, you know, we're able to make a short turn on some of these investments, you know, that just didn't happen in that capacity. So I think, you know, the mistakes is when you kind of get outside of your investment thesis, right? You start to figure out, well, why is this deal? You try to make the deal work. I think it were some of the mistakes that we made early on and, you know, and some of those deals.
Well, I think as we sort of get to the end of our time, I would love to know if there's anything that you'd want to share. Like, if you had sort of one piece of advice that you could share that you think would be most successful for folks who are interested in going down a path of owning and adding value to and appreciating and building wealth through owning real estate, like, what would that be? What would you share?
Yeah, I think for me and Dre and Vince, they always remind me, and we all come together, is like, be really good at the small thing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is when you're starting small, it's like, own that part, like, become the best at wherever you're at, you know, in that component. Because, you know, trying to chase after, you know, if you have 4 units and you're trying to say, hey, I want to go do a 200 unit deal, it's possible. But have you really learned how to operate a property? Have you really learned how to master where you are, you know, in that space? And that can come through education or real life experience. But I think don't be afraid to really, like, roll your sleeves up and master things at a small level and build those up. Because in my trajectory, I think a good amount of other trajectories, is not this linear curve of, like, you know, that goes up like this. It is kind of that exponential where for a long time, it's like you're trailing this and not seeing a lot of movement. And then you kind of see the bump. And so be willing in that kind of period where you don't see a bunch of inflection to really own your craft, learn your craft, because you're going to need it when the fuel really starts to come in and the pedal hits the metal in that curve.
I have a friend who says we should always be legendary. Whatever you're at, be legendary. If you are just a first-year analyst, then be the most legendary analyst.
Yeah,
and that's good. You know, yeah. If you're working there, whatever job it is, whatever you have, be legendary at it. And so
yeah.
We are very lucky today to be talking to one of the legends of New Orleans, Michael Meredith. So thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, you take care.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.